Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jury deliberations continue today in the Bella Bond murder trial. The jurors must decide whether defendant Michael McCarthy is guilty of killing the 2-year-old toddler whose remains were found on Deer Island in 2015. Now, there were a couple of strange things that happened towards the end of this trial, some late decisions made by the Suffolk Superior Court judge that have enraged McCarthy's defense team, and we want to explore those complications. So here to explain is Brad Bailey. He's a criminal defense attorney not affiliated with this case. He's also a former assistant district attorney for Middlesex County and former assistant U.S. attorney in Boston. Brad Bailey, welcome to you.
My pleasure to be here.
We're really glad to have you because a couple of things happened late in this case which honestly left me quite confused. And I'm hoping you can help us set the record straight in terms of whether or not these things are unusual and how common they are in Massachusetts courtrooms.
Sure.
So the first thing is that on Monday, Judge Sanders at the Suffolk Superior Court actually agreed to a request by the prosecution to add involuntary manslaughter to the list of possible verdicts in this case against Michael McCarthy. I mean, that's really late in the trial to add a possible verdict, isn't it?
Well, jury instructions and what charges are submitted to the jury are usually decided upon and discussed at the close of the evidence, but before the parties make closing arguments. So the timing of that particular decision wasn't that unusual. And in Massachusetts, whenever there's a first-degree murder case, the jury and the defendant is entitled to consider a second-degree murder charge as a lesser included offense. But very often in these murder cases, there's real argument over whether or not manslaughter or the derivative of manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, also has a basis to be submitted to the jury. Usually it's the defense that's arguing or asking for that. So it was a little bit unusual that it was the prosecution, but it wasn't that unusual that manslaughter was being debated at that point and at that time.
Okay, interesting. Now tell us, what's the sort of legal distinctions between first or second degree murder and manslaughter?
Well, in this particular case, under these facts, while it's an unlawful killing under involuntary manslaughter, it's an unlawful killing that was unintentionally caused under this theory by a battery which the defendant knew or should have known created a high degree of likelihood that substantial harm would result to another. So it's not the intentional killing and the malice aforethought that is required in the murder charges. In fact, it's an unintentional causation charge, but under circumstances where, as in this case, if believed or if the facts support it, that punching or striking a toddler with force on the body should have foreseeably been seen to have a high degree of likelihood that substantial harm might result.
So I think the thing that I struggle with, I'm a little confused by being a legal layperson here, is that, I mean, is this a new charge that they're adding? And if so, how is a defense team supposed to craft a defense if things are getting added so late in the trial?
Well, it's certainly something that the defense argued vociferously that there was really no basis in the evidence to submit that or support that. And that's really what any appellate court is going to look at if that was wrong for Judge Sanders to have allowed the jury to consider it. Was there a basis? Was there any sort of interpretation of the evidence where that should have been submitted? And again, it's unusual that it was the prosecution and not the defense requesting it. And I think it suggests that the prosecution realizes there are some real issues with its proof and with its case. But the bigger issue is what happened after argument yesterday, where the prosecutor requested an instruction suggesting that they didn't have to show that Michael McCarthy alone was responsible for the death.
Well, so hang on for a second, Brad, if you could, because we actually have tape from court of this exact moment that you're talking about. First of all, just to sort of set some context, we are going to hear from Jonathan Shapiro. He's Michael McCarthy's defense attorney, and this is what he said during his closing arguments, that in Jonathan Shapiro's eyes, that jurors need to acquit Michael McCarthy if they do not believe he's the sole perpetrator of this crime.
The question that will be facing you when you deliberate on a verdict is whether the prosecution has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. McCarthy, and only Mr. McCarthy, murdered Bella Bond.
So again, that's Jonathan Shapiro, defense attorney, and I'm guessing he's making that explicit argument because of Rochelle Bond, Bella Bond's mother, who was a witness for the prosecution, obviously a problematic person in this case. But then after the closing arguments, Judge Sanders told the jury this.
Mr. Shapiro stated, I think at the beginning of his closing argument, that you can find Mr. McCarthy guilty only if you conclude that Mr. McCarthy and Mr. McCarthy alone killed Bella. As to that, I would simply instruct you as follows. The Commonwealth bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. McCarthy killed Bella. On the other hand, the Commonwealth does not have the burden of excluding the possibility that one or more other persons were also involved in the crime.
Brad Bailey, what does this mean?
Well, it certainly means that there was a real shift in the Commonwealth or the prosecution's theory of the case. And to have that come after closings and after the defense's entire defense was based on the theory that there was nobody else who could possibly have done it except either Mr. McCarthy in the eyes of the Commonwealth or Rochelle Bond in the eyes of the defense, that's amounts to completely sandbagging and potentially sabotaging his entire case because, according to Mr. Shapiro, he had never been placed on any type of notice that the Commonwealth might suggest that the evidence would show that somebody other than Michael McCarthy committed this murder. And so he had every right to be upset, not just by the substance of that particular charge, but by the timing, because presumably he had every right to assume that these issues were all vetted at the pre-charge conference that happened before the closing. And he based his entire closing on that.
Brad, can I just ask you, I mean, it seems as if this is my conjecture, okay? But it seems as if these changes happened late in the trial because, you know, as you said, the Commonwealth may have recognized that its case possibly wasn't as strong as it would have liked it to be. Okay. But on the other hand, there's the question of the fundamental fairness of what goes on in a courtroom. I mean, did these late decisions, could they possibly be grounds for a claim of mistrial by McCarthy and his defense team?
Well, I think that they may well be grounds for a possible viable appeal and or a new trial. And I think that they will be revisited if, in fact, he is convicted of either first or second degree murder in this case. Now, the prosecution is going to counter on appeal that the defense opened the door by stepping into the role of judge during their closing argument and instructing the jury on a proposition that the judge found to be improper. And therefore, they invited the correction that throws a monkey wrench into their argument. But again, there's no stretch of any aspect of the Commonwealth's case where they suggested that, and beyond that, this was not a situation where Rochelle Bond was originally charged with murder, and then the charges were reduced to accessory after the fact. She has been charged consistently with accessory after the fact, so there's been no notice to the defense whatsoever. And also, one has to wonder about the way the charge was given, in that it's clearly on a joint venture theory of liability.
Yeah.
But where's the full instruction on helping the jury to understand the application and the meaning of a joint venture murder? So there are issues that absolutely will be revisited on appeal and may resonate if, in fact, there is a guilty verdict on first or second degree murder here.
Such strange complications to a really tragic, tragic case. We'll keep our eyes on what happens with the jury as they continue to deliberate and, of course, their decision when they make it. Brad Bailey, criminal defense attorney, former assistant district attorney for Middlesex County, and former assistant U.S. attorney in Boston. Thank you so much for walking us through these delicate questions. Much appreciated.
Thanks for inviting me to join you.